It's a Sunday afternoon. Welcome again to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. Today's show features the very special, inimitable Robert Bly reading at Asheville's Dinah Wortham Theater from March 28th of this year. Bly has been one of the leading lights of poetry in these states since the publication of Silence in the Snowy Fields in, I think it was 1962. This reading features him celebrating the publication of his most recent volume of translations from the Persian of the Iranian poet Hafez. He's accompanied throughout the reading by the musicians of Free Planet Radio, Chris Rosser, River Gregorian, and Elliot Wadopian. Here we go.
So we have three other poets I want to do for you, and I think I'll do this one, and then we'll have a break and come back and do a couple more. The three poets... Hafez and Rumi and Mirbai, or Hafez and Mirbai and Rumi. I mean, we're talking about the soul. And some of the translations Coleman has done of Rumi are absolutely marvelous things. So, but we'll begin with Hafez, and this is a wonderful day for me because this book just arrived outside. I'd never seen it before. I mean, I've seen one copy, but that's all. And this is Hafez. It's called The Angels Knocking on the Tavern Door. And Hafez is from Iran. And when Coleman and I went to Iran last year, we went to Hafez's grave. He lived around 1450, somewhere near. But everyone loves Hafez in Iran. They have Hafez on the dining room. Rumi's okay, but Hafez, whoa. So everyone has a copy of Hafez on the table. His collected works of 450 poems he wrote, very elaborate ones. And they use it the way we use the I Ching. You know, if your daughter's thinking of marrying some stupid guy, you check the I Ching. You know, here you check Hafez, and he'll tell you. And that's the way they do that. So there's no one in our tradition that is loved as much as they love Hafez. And so we went early in the morning to Hafez's grave in Tehran. And it's kind of a park, and there are beautiful pillars there, and his tomb is down there, the stone and everything. And so we just sat down there writing bad poems, you know, and enjoying ourselves. And about 7:30 in the morning, the children started to come. The third grade class came, and they stood around Hafez's stone and sang a song of Hafez. So, you see, the thing is that I said to Coleman, wouldn't it be great if we could do that at Whitman's grave? I mean, why shouldn't American children come to Whitman's grave? Isn't that right? So, but we're so dumb, you know? We just leave them out in some damn cemetery somewhere. I don't know where he is even. But, of course, they can also sing, and we haven't worked at that place yet in which you can actually, you can't sing Whitman, but he didn't sing it himself. Anyway, we're just talking about that experience. Then we waited, and now the third graders came, a little class, all these little kids standing there, smiling and looking at each other's dresses, and they sing in Song of Hafez. This went on all morning. So that's called a country with culture. So, and Iran was lovely, really. We'd walk down the street, and people come up to us and say, "Oh, you're Americans, we love Americans." And they meant it, they love Americans. The government doesn't, but they do. So this is one of their fantastic poets, Hafez. Nobody knows much about him. He got in trouble once, apparently, because it's very hard to stay out of trouble in Iran, especially if you shoot your mouth off, which he did all the time. And apparently once the police came to the house and his wife was frightened, and she burned about 20 of the poems. But that's the only poems we know that were lost. All right, are you guys ready? This is called The Lost Daughter. All of you, come in right away. That's good. Send out the criers. Go to the marketplace of souls. Hear, hear, all of you in the colony of lovers. Here it is. For several days, the daughter of the wine is reported lost. That's a little reference to wine, which the Muslims don't want you to deal with, as well as some good-looking women. They're not sure about that either. For several days now, the daughter of the wine is reported lost. Call your friends. Whoever is near her is in danger. Her dress is ruby-colored. Her hair is done in seafoam. She takes away reason. Be alert. Watch out for her. If you find this bitter one, you can have my soul for dessert. If she's in the underworld, then that's the place to go. She's a night woman, blameless, disreputable, and red. If you do find her, please bring her to Hafez's house. So it's a tradition with this poem that we don't have in English at all. Yes, this is I'm going to do a couple of poems that are related to the Ghazal of the Ghazal. And the poet mentions his name or her name in the last stanza. And the reason is because this is a culture that for 1500 years has been creating great poems, and they don't publish. They memorize. So someone will give a poem of Hafez and, out in way out in the country, and the next day it'll be sung in a bar in Iran. And the only way they can say whose poem it is if the Rumi and Hafez get the habit of putting their name in the last stanza. Now that's a meaning for that. When the one I love accepts the wine, then there could be a woman. But it could be God. When was the last time you offered a glass of wine to God? And isn't it? I'm a Protestant, we don't do that much. When the one I love accepts the wine, then the shop of the false idols falls down. I have dropped in a heap on the earth crying, in the hope that I'll feel the touch of his hand. I have dropped in a heap on the earth crying, in the hope that I'll feel the touch of his hand. I have fallen like a fish into deep water, in the hope that the friend will catch me in his net. I've fallen like a fish into deep water, in the hope that the friend will catch me in his net. Whoever looks into his luminous eyes cries, someone is already drunk, get the police. How blessed is the man who, like Hafez, has tasted in his heart the wine made before Adam. How blessed is the man who, like Hafez, has tasted in his heart the wine made before Adam. I love that, don't you? Fantastic. So it is true, you don't want to compare, but Emily Dickinson tasted the wine made before Adam. Is this true? Well, if it's true, say yes.
Yes!
What a dopey gun. Did Whitman taste the wine made before Adam?
Yes!
Yes! Thank you, that felt good. All right, let's do this one. The Dust of the Doorway. I'm not about to abandon love, nor the secret witness, nor the cup of wine. I have sworn off these things 100 times, and I won't do it again. I won't agree either that the garden of paradise and the shade trees of heaven and the dancing of playful angels are as good as the ragged dust of your street. Everything the great teachers have to say amounts to a single hint. I've already dropped that hint once. I won't drop it again. The only time I receive any grasp of the state of my own mind is when, lying flat, I can't lift my head from the tavern door. Now, the Muslims say, mustn't do that. You get in trouble. The counselor spoke contemptuously to me. He said, wine is forbidden, period. I agree with you, I said. Also, I don't listen to every jackass. Don't stay here, the angry sheikh said. And by the way, give up, love. And he said, there's no need, brother, for a fight here. I simply won't do that. The poverty I have is right for me. I don't go up in the pulpit and flirt and throw glances to the beautiful young women who are present. Hafez, the arch door of the Zoroastrian master is a site of wealth and abundance. As for kneeling and kissing the dust of that doorway, I will keep on doing that. To spend even one moment grieving about this world is a waste of time. Let's go and sell our robes for ordinary wine. Who says robes are better than wine? In the crooked alleys where the wine sellers hang out, a prayer mat man might not even buy one glass of wine. What does that say about prayer mats? Can you feel this flavor? He's always right on the edge. They're about to arrest him. The tavern keeper scolded me and said, saying I should turn my face away from the door. Why is this? The dust on the door sill has more value than the head. Hidden inside the crown of a king, there's always the fear of assassination. A crown is a stylish hat, but a head is too much to pay for it. That's nice. The crown is a stylish hat, but the head is too much to pay for it. It's better to turn your face away from all your admirers. The joy the general receives from dominating the world is not worth the suffering of the army. It's best to aim, as Hafez does, for contentment and abandon what belongs to the low world. One grain of indebtedness in the base life weighs more than 100 bushels of gold. All right, so that's a little bit of Hafez.
This is Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. We're listening to poet Robert Bly reading at the Diana Wortham Theater in March of this year. Let's continue with Bly reading his own recent work, for which he's adapted the Ghazal, the Persian form in which Hafez wrote.
A request? All right. If you want one, I'll give you a good one. I published a book recently called My Sentence Was a Thousand Years of Joy. And this book is written in the Ghazal form. And that's the primary form in the Muslim world. And we have never done it in English, but this is the way it goes. You're given 36 syllables to say what you want to say. And they use two 18-syllable lines. But American poets who don't look carefully do two 12-syllable lines, it's 24 syllables. You can't say anything in 24 syllables. That's why they made it 36. So then when you've said your thing in 36 syllables, then you have to stop, and the next stanza has to sound something different. This one being a big help to Milton. So these people are smart. So then you can have 6 to 8 of those stanzas, and then the last stanza, you'll mention the poet, the woman or man will mention his own name or her own name, which is typical in this tradition. And there's another quality too, that in some of the poems, they do not rhyme, but every stanza ends with the same word. That's interesting. Boom. The whole word comes in. So I wrote 48 of them in a book which was called The Night Abraham Called to the Stars. And then I wrote another book, My Sins Was a Thousand Years of Joy. And it took 4 years for each of them, 48 poems in each one. So it turned out to take about one poem a month. So they're difficult to do. I will do one called Stealing Sugar from the Castle. You ready? You come in first, and then second stanza you come in, third stanza you come in. Planning, good planning. We are poor students. We stay after school to study joy. We are like those birds on the India mountains. I am a widow whose child is her only joy. Ask what you want for. We are poor students who stay after school to study joy. We are like those birds in the India mountains. I am a widow whose child is her only joy. The only thing I hold in my ant-like head is the builder's plan of the castle of sugar. Just to steal one grain of sugar is a joy. And that's really what translation is like. It's stealing sugar. That's why I look healthy. The only thing I hold in my ant-like head is the builder's plan of the castle of sugar. Just to steal one grain of sugar is a joy. This is from Beowulf time. What is human life like? A bird flies out of the snow into a hall, and everybody's down there singing and carrying on, then flies out through the other window. Like a bird, we fly out of darkness into the hall, which is lit with singing, and then fly out again. Being shut out of the warm hall is also a joy. I'm a laggard, a loafer, and an idiot. One of my children said to me, Dad, you're not a loafer. I'm a laggard, a loafer, and an idiot. But I'd love to read about those who caught one glimpse of the face and died 20 years later in joy. I'm a laggard, a loafer, and an idiot. But I'd love to read about those who caught one glimpse of the face and died 20 years later in joy. I don't mind your saying I will die soon. People say, aren't you going to die pretty soon, Robert? I say, it's none of your business. I don't mind your saying I will die soon. Even in the sound of the word soon, I hear the word you, which begins every sentence of joy. I don't mind your saying I will die soon. Even in the sound of the word soon, I hear the word you, which begins every sentence of joy. You're a thief, the judge said. Let's see your hands. I showed my calloused hands in court. My sentence was 1,000 years of joy. So you want to hear a couple more of these little things? So, you know, when you're doing these last words, you have to choose good words, because I tried to, end up with house, it's boring, and but you're going to use it 6 times. So I decided that non-existence was a good word. So I did it. I mean, I got lots of time, you know what I mean? And this is a tradition. The Muslims say there are two things: existence and non-existence. And God has existence. So guess who's got non-existence? I like that. It's very clear. And all right, let's go. We'll begin with you back there. Isn't that amazing what music can do? Your whole body hears it. When I hear that we all belong to non-existence, I drop my eyes. But then I raise them out of love for the little creatures of non-existence. Some say that perch become like each other to keep the shark from zeroing in. I mean, I was in one of those aquariums, and the fish went right in. I said, what the hell is going on? My friend said, that's to keep the shark from zeroing in on them. Some say that perch become like each other to keep the shark from zeroing in. But staying alive doesn't mean we are free from non-existence. This is a farm boy's poem. The cries of the infant barn swallows, rising from the mud nest, fastened ingeniously to the rafters, taught me to love the skinny birds of non-existence. The cries of the infant barn swallows, rising from the mud nests, fastened ingeniously to the rafters, taught me to love the skinny birds of non-existence. Taoists, I have to change the subject, right? Taoists with their thin beards, fishing all day with a straight hook. That's how they taught their students. Taoists with their thin beards, fishing all day with a straight hook. Tell us, they have learned not to expect a whole lot from non-existence. And this was the first stanza, and I had to write 5 more. Blackberries have so many faces that their jam is a kind of thickening of nothing. Each of us loves to eat the thick syrup of non-existence. Blackberries have so many faces that their jam is a kind of thickening of nothing. Each of us loves to eat the thick syrup of non-existence. Last stanza. When each stanza closes with the same word, I'm glad. A friend says, if you're proud of that, you must be one of the secretaries of non-existence. All right, maybe you'd like to have existence then, huh? You want existence?
Yeah.
All right, I guess existence. It cost me a lot of work, this poem. I hope you like it. But it's so interesting because most of my life I've written free verse. You know, you just send it off to Poetry Magazine, no problem. But they pay you 25 cents, you know. The bridegroom. Let's begin with you. The bridegroom wanted to reach the Norwegian church, but the roads were made impassable by huge snows. We are each the bridegroom longing for existence. Marriage brings the moth close to the candle flame. They tend to fall asleep, you know. Marriage brings the moth close to the candle flame with their frail wings. Men and women are constantly flying into the fire of existence. Is that right? With their frail wings, men and women are constantly flying into the fire of existence. Some say that each drop of groundwater in Kansas knows about the ocean. How can this be? Each drop of water longs, like us, for existence. Some say that each drop of groundwater in Kansas knows about the ocean. How can this be? Every drop of water longs, like us, for existence. And the next one mentions an old Muslim saint, Abu Sayyid, who fasted in the desert for 20 years. And his only friend there was a little dragon. Then he went into town and he, you know, began to drink chai and everything and had a good time. After 10 years, he went back again and the little dragon was still there. This is the story. Abu Sayyid fasted in the desert for 20 years. Later, when he came back, his dragon friend wept and said, "Your suffering gave me a hint of existence." I thought that was so beautiful. Dragons don't suffer, I guess. He said to the human being, "Your suffering gave me a hint of existence." And this is my wife playing Bach on the piano. When the pianist's fingers strike all the notes in the 10th prelude, it's clear that Bach's soul has been leaping about like a hare in the field of existence. When the pianist's fingers strike all the notes in the 10th prelude, it's clear that Bach's soul has been leaping about like a hare in the field of existence. Isn't it beautiful to hear this music behind it? Whoa. Last stanza. Robert, you're close to joy, but not quite there. You are a hunchback standing in an Italian square looking in at the festival of existence. Leopardi actually was a humpback. And he'd do this on Saturday night when everyone was out singing in the Italian squares. He'd go on one little side thing and watch. Robert, you're close to joy, but not quite there. You are a hunchback standing in an Italian square, looking in at the festival of existence. Okay, thank you. Well, this is a pleasure that you asked me to read my own poems when I intended on reading someone else's, but I probably read enough of someone else's. I'll read one more of mine, and then we'll go back to where we were. I'm going to take these guys with me. All right, would you like to hear another one of the repeating word? This time I took a phrase. It's already too late. That feels so good to say that. It's already too late. Robert, why didn't you write better poems? It's already too late. Why don't you pay your income tax? It's already too late. So there's a lot of juice in that one. Okay, let's have you begin. Sharam Nazari is an Iranian singer who I love. This is called Listening to Shoam Nazari. I know the horses keep galloping for miles. I know the ants keep lifting their feelers to heaven and planning new triumphs, but it's already too late. I want you to hit that late when we do it. It's already too late. When Nazari sings, I don't care if the second heaven comes down or not. I don't care if my words get you to cry or not. It's already too late. When Nazari sings, I don't care if the second Adam comes down or not. I don't care if my words get you to cry or not. It's already too late. The smell of coffee spreads out from the fire. The wild-haired old women sing over the coffin. Go on complaining and praying. It's already too late. Go on complaining and praying. It's already too late. I don't know, that makes me feel happy, that line. Go on complaining and crying. That's what language is incredible. It's already too late. I know sweet vowels and inescapable rhythms. And I know how sweet it is when a young woman is here and the old men think of God. But it's already too late. I know sweet vowels and inescapable rhythms. And I know how sweet it is when a young woman is here and the old men think of God, but it's already too late. My tongue never becomes bitter because my mouth keeps holding the grief pipe between my teeth. Did you hear that? I learned that from some of the old ones. Grief is a beautiful thing. That's very different than bitterness or sadness. Grief, beautiful. My tongue never becomes bitter because my mouth keeps holding the grief pipe between my teeth. Go on and conquer bitterness. It's already too late. Go on and conquer bitterness. It's already too late. Good. Roll. Here I am. I'm all alone. It's early morning. I am so happy. How can so much grandeur live beneath my skin? Go on asking. It's already too late. Say it with me. It's already too late. Oh, this is a good audience. I'm coming back here. Well, all right, here's a toughie. All right, let's begin this time with you. I don't think I've ever read this aloud. Have we forgotten the nest in which we were born? Have we forgotten the scrawny heads and the stickly floor? Have we forgotten the cries and the wide open beaks? How old were we before we forgave those other ones in the nest? Probably it's our own necks that should be swinging in the wind. Last night I dreamt that my brother drowned. His body did not come in, and he had a wife and children. Waters kept arriving. At last I saw his shirt. That is a dream. And the good thing with a poem like this, you don't have to interpret it, because you got to move on to the next stanza. We were halfway over the ocean, with the oars broken, water is coming in through cracks. A blind old man is guiding our route by the stars. That's what it feels like. I've lived a lot of years with stupid people running the government. We are in a rowboat halfway over the ocean with the sails broken. Water is coming in through cracks. A blind old man is guiding our route by the stars. What shall we do with the stories that old men tell? Some say a shaggy being older than Adam established a prison inside a grain of rice. People say that some shaggy being older than Adam established a prison inside the grain of rice. One hair left on the goat's chin will be enough to bring it down lightning on a stormy night if we have forgotten the nest in which we were born. One reason to write poetry is that you're eventually forced to write about your family. And that's a blessing. I'm going to have a poetry workshop tomorrow, and I think I'll make them all write about their family. One hair left on the goat's chin will be enough to bring down lightning on a stormy night if we have forgotten the nest in which we were born. I'll do one more and then we'll do something else. Like go home. Well, I'm listening. All right, let's do this one then. The advantage of this form, called the gazelle or the guzzle, is that you only have to continue your thought for three lines. So you can say a lot of things you'd get trapped in other poems. Here I say, it's all right if Suzanne goes on painting the same picture. Well, that could get me in a lot of trouble to defend that idea. But I don't defend it. I just say it and change the subject. Right, let's have you begin. Isn't it sweet with these guys here? It's so wonderful. It's all right if Suzanne goes on painting the same picture. It's all right if juice tastes bitter in our mouths. It's all right if the old man drags one useless foot. But I can't go on saying this, you know what I mean? I've had my three lines and I have to change the subject. The apple on the tree of paradise hangs there for months. We wait for years and years on the lip of the falls. And the blue-gray mountain keeps rising behind the black trees. It's all right if I feel the same pain until I die. It's all right if I feel this same pain until I die. Is that right? It's all right. It's all right if I feel this. It's all right if he feels that same pain until he dies. A pain that we have earned gives more nourishment than the joy we won at the lottery last night. Is that right? Pain that we have earned. That's called being married. The pain that we have earned gives more nourishment. That's when people get divorced too quick, you know, they're trying to escape from pain, but God doesn't want that. The pain that we have earned gives more nourishment than the joy we won at the lottery last night. It's all right if the partridge's nest fills with snow. Why should the hunter complain if his bag is empty at dusk? It only means the bird will live another night.
It's all right if we turn in all our keys tonight. It's all right if we give up our longing for the spiral. It's all right if the boat I love never reaches shore. That's the best line. It's all right if the boat that I love never reaches shore. Last stanza. If we're already so close to death, why should we complain? Robert, you've climbed on so many trees to reach the nests. It's all right if you grow your wings on the way down. Robert, you've climbed so many trees to reach the nest. That's about writing poetry, isn't it? You've climbed so many trees to reach the nest. It's all right if you grow your wings on the way down. That's a sort of forgiveness of myself. I don't know what it is, but it felt good to write it anyway.
PVM 103.5, LPFM, Asheville, North Carolina, and this is Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. The day after the performance at Dinah Wortham, Bly led an all-day workshop, as he mentioned, and at the end of it, he was tired, but he still had enough energy to sit down for a short interview. Here are some parts of that interview. Robert, how did you come to be to work with music in your poetry?
I have two friends in Minneapolis. One plays the sitar and the other plays the tablas. When I walked into a session of a conference maybe 20 or 25 years ago, I heard it. Uh-huh. I said, whoa, this will be great. So we started doing that right then, and we've been doing it ever since.
Really?
Yeah. The sitar is perfect for coming in the lines of a poem.
Uh-huh.
And the tabla gives a lot of energy. So I've been convinced ever since that this is a perfect way to give poetry in public.
Uh-huh, yeah.
The human voice is kind of naked when it's up there.
Yeah.
And so the music helps the audience understand what the feelings are going to be.
You said last night that in cultures where music is routinely used as to accompany poetry, the music provides a transport, so you're already transported before the poetry starts.
Yeah, that's good. Very good.
Yeah, I thought that
those
was
two
really...
men, those three men last night were superb.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the best musicians I've ever worked with.
Oh, they're all great, yeah.
And
yeah.
I would just start a poem, and they'd be there in a fraction of a second. They would know exactly where it was and what kind of the mood, what the mood was going to be.
Yeah.
That was a real pleasure.
Yeah, they're all very good, and you did a great job directing them, I thought. With just a little rehearsal. I guess you had some rehearsal time.
Yeah, we had a half an hour or so.
Half an hour or so, yeah.
Yeah, but they're so wonderful. I would just point to one to start, and
right. He'd
come in, depending on the poem.
Yeah.
But that was a great pleasure for me.
Well, it was a great show, too. I know it seems to me, at least, that you're now, perhaps, you've always been a great poet of image, you know, or at least since the 60s, since Silence in the Snowy Fields. But it seems to me you're more conscious now of the musicality of your own verse, of your own words, of the music within the poem. Has that been an evolution? Has that been something you've always been very mindful of? Or is it something that you find new?
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. I began, you know, with what is called free verse, which means... That no verse, of course, is free if you're really paying attention to it. But
right.
no particular musical opportunities or severities were brought into it. But later, as I began to work more and more with the poems, and I started doing some guzzles or gazelles. Mm-hmm. And this is the primary literary poetry form in the whole Near East.
Right.
And the word gazelle or guzzle actually means music.
Huh.
It means a piece of music, which is a testimony to the fact that the Near Eastern poets have always had poetry connected with music.
Hmm.
So I was amazed when I found the form that they had developed. The form has 36 syllables in which you're supposed to say what you have to say.
Uh-huh.
And then the mood changes and the subject changes for the next 36 syllables.
Hmm.
Well, music often works in that way too.
Yeah.
So after you finish 36 syllables, then the musicians can bring in a different mood.
Uh-huh.
So I've enjoyed that tremendously, having a poem. It's much more satisfying to have form in the poem and then have the form of music,
mm-hmm.
rather than having a free verse and then the form of music. So I've loved all that. And
yeah.
The guzzle form is something that hasn't been developed for centuries. I think it goes back to the 9th or 10th centuries.
Hmm.
And Rumi has many poems that are guzzles. Coleman hasn't translated them that way. He's translated them as free verse.
Uh-huh.
But he's done a superb job. And Hafez, that I've just finished right. working with, all of his poems are guzzles or gazelles.
Uh-huh. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you've also translated some from Ghalib.
Yes, Ghalib doesn't use the gazelle. He has
He
has a. It's done with music, but a different sort of music.
Okay, right. Hmm. So was Hafez the first poet you started working with in terms of the ghazal or the
yes.
gazelle? Yeah. Hmm.
And he's still the greatest. I mean, people just, you know, who really understand Farsi, they fall over when they hear
uh-huh.
a single stanza of Hafez.
Of Hafez.
I do too.
Well, they're remarkable poems. They really are.
Yeah, and the amazing thing is that usually we have poems such as Wordsworth that have great nature mm-hmm. Components to them and absolutely beautiful. And then if people talk about culture, it's usually in the form of the rhymed couplet or something like that of Pope.
Right.
Pope dealt not with nature but with culture.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so the amazing thing then, and someone said to me last night, you know, your early poems like Silence in the Snowy Fields are all connected with nature,
mm-hmm.
whereas these poems are connected with culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I name a whole lot of cultural figures
mm-hmm.
that have meant things to me.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't fit into iambic, but they'll fit into a guzzle very well.
Uh-huh.
And he named, this person named something like 42 people that I have brought into the gazelles.
Huh.
And so I think that's very interesting.
Yeah,
it's a very interesting
that
idea
is.
That you could write ecstatic poems about culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what a concept. What a concept.
Yeah, what a concept, yeah. especially for us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been the best blessing to me in the last 20 years has mm-hmm. been discovering the form of the ghazal and the reading of the great poems that Hafez has done. I just, my friend and I, Leonard Lewison, who is the greatest Farsi scholar in England, had brought out the new ghazal book.
You just saw it for the first time yesterday.
Yeah, right? Yesterday I saw it for the first time. And actually, the book has something like 30 ghazals, and it's taken us 14 years to do it.
Wow.
Because I know nothing about Farsi, and the number of references to cultural matters and matters is just huge. And so Leonard Lewison, who is a great Muslim scholar in England,
mm-hmm.
would fly over to America in like for 3 weeks every summer for 14 years. And we'd sit in the dining room working like mad.
Dictionaries 12, out.
Everything out. Yeah. Commentaries, there's 94 different commentaries on Hafez. And his work is so complicated. It refers to Muslim, many Muslim ideas. It doesn't agree with all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And what's more, he loved wine, which was not recommended among the Muslims. And so he has to carry all that at the same time, defend himself for using wine. And so they're very complicated and fantastic and wonderful poems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me get you to jump back quite a ways. What was the landscape of American poetry like when you came on the scene and started writing in the 50s?
Well, it was a landscape dominated by English poetry, which is not at all unusual.
Right.
I mean, we learned all that from them. And they happened to have rhymed iambic pentameter in sonnets.
Mm-hmm.
And Whitman recognized this won't do. And so he wrote those long, shaggy poems that are so great.
Right.
But we had, I had, young poets that time had no other place to go to besides English poetry.
Right.
So I began to, in a book called Silence in the Snowy Fields, I began to model poems of mine after Antonio Machado and Juan Ramon Jimenez, Spanish poets, who were very alive in the 20th century. And so that was a great joy for me. And I still like those poems, and I still like all of the great Spanish poets. But Iran is something different. I mean, whoa, that goes way back. That's a 100,000-year-old culture.
Yeah, there. Way deep.
So I was absolutely astounded when I read the first poems of Hafez. And Justice Coleman was astounded when he read what Rumi was saying.
Mm-hmm.
It's what Whitman always wanted to say, but didn't quite have the background to be able to make it that witty and that funny and that...
Yeah.
Yeah. So...
Or the tradition. I mean, Whitman was just starting out. I mean, he was clearing the land.
Yes,
you know?
He was. And but I love the way the Americans have taken up Coleman's translation. Didn't you say that something like how much? How many?
Three quarters of a million copies
of poems have been sold.
Yeah, the most read poet in the United States.
Yeah, so we mustn't be, we have to be glad about that, because if it had been England, it would have been 15,000.
Yeah.
But here, a quarter of a million? Whoa. So that's that was due to the 60s, and there was something in the 60s that was open to people like Rumi.
Yeah.
And some of the old 60 people are still alive.
That's right.
Buying them and giving them to their kids.
Gadzooks. Well, yeah. And you were one of those people in the 60s, of course, who helped open that up.
Yeah, we did the best we could.
Yeah, well. What was, I know early on you were associated with the whole deep image approach, I guess one should say, to poetry. You used to talk about imagery a lot in your readings, and I remember you quoting Galway Kinnell's translation, what is it, an interior sea lighted by turning eagles. That is an image of Yves Bonfoy. Did that come out of your experience with the Spanish poets?
Yes.
The interest in image?
Yeah. And so a poem can be carried by Ben Ideas. That's good.
Mm-hmm.
Pope is like that.
Right.
it can be carried by extremely complicated thoughts. Mm-hmm. Emily Dickinson.
Mm-hmm.
This is thought of the heart that she's got.
Mm-hmm.
And it's complicated. And it's wonderful. But I think our amazement was in seeing poems that were really dominated by the ecstasy of the image.
Mm-hmm.
And clearing out the rest of the things and allowing the image to do most of that.
Uh-huh.
And for us, it meant cleaning out, getting rid of the iambic pentameter,
mm-hmm.
and to some extent getting rid of the sonnet and even of the poem that would have stanzas in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And let all of that move. So it was a lucky... And our poetry has more connection with Spain and with Iran than it does with England.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ask me why. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But probably the Native American influence is present somewhere.
Yeah.
That's a long, that's even farther from the English.
Mm-hmm.
And Whitman already sensed that, that this was going to be a new continent, mm-hmm. needed a new poetry. So, I don't know, it just feels awfully lucky to me, for me, to be living in such a wonderful time for poetry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the fact that not many people read it, so what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
In its own time. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead. Ask me one more question and we better quit.
One more question. I know you've been concerned at least since the 70s with issues of masculinity and femininity. And I wondered how that happened to arise for you. Was that did you encounter that through the Spanish poets or the ecstatic poets? What was it that brought that recognition to you that things were vastly screwed up here in this particular culture in that regard?
Well, I don't think anyone needs books to know that men are in a lot of trouble. And it's Indeed. Not their trouble. I mean, it's capitalism.
Yeah.
When capitalism was in and says to the man, you know, you don't need to be out in nature. You can be in a little office.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to be polite. You can be a bastard.
Mm-hmm.
And
we'll reward you for being a bastard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the bigger the bastard, the bigger.
Yeah.
All of that has had a huge disturbance in the world of men. And I began by working with women. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was
the Great Mother
feminist
Conference
for a long time.
Right.
And then mm-hmm. I said, well, it's wonderful the way the women are getting together. Why don't the men do that?
Mm-hmm.
So I called a conference on men. You know, and 100 freaky guys came, and we had a lovely time talking about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the women were alarmed, but actually there was no anti-feminist stuff in it at all.
Right. Right.
And they soon realized that. I mean, we hardly mentioned women in these sessions because everyone had such a strong need to talk about their fathers. It was mm-hmm. the fathers that was feeding that whole disturbance, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the jobs, of course, are bad, but basically it was the fathers leaving the house, working until 9 at night, mm-hmm. never seeing their sons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the old culture of that I was brought up in, of farming, you were with your father all the time. I was with my father all the time, spring, right. summer, winter, fall, beginning of the day, end of the day, and that was natural to me. And so in some way I had a better understanding or feeling for this connection of others and fathers and sons than many of the men I was talking to did.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I became, so to speak, leader of it. I mean, there are many that did wonderful things and are still doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Martine Prechtel is an absolute genius in talking to men, and many others are there, but it worked, and the men were feeling, you know, we need someone who would talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
Will you do it? I said, okay. If you pay me, I will.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you listen to my poems, I will.
Yeah.
And it turned out that the men were excellent. And, yeah, well, were you reading poems to men? You know, I tell you, some of the men who had never read a poem in their life can understand the depth of any poem I've ever written, I tell you.
Yeah.
And so that was a big surprise to me, because
mm-hmm.
there are so many hundreds of ways in which we look down on men,
right?
And most of them are completely wrong. Well, maybe we should end there. Hmm?
Thanks so much. Me. I know it's been a long day for you, and I really appreciate your taking the time. Wordplay for this week. Check out naturespoetry.blogspot.com for more information about today's show. And a special wordplay happy birthday goes out to Robert Bly, who celebrates his birthday this Tuesday. He'll be 82.